is being pulled down through the murky green depths by a pair of hands gripping one of her pretty legs. It promised, like all these covers, two things: sex and death. I ran my thumb along the edge of the book, riffling the pages, and that musty, prickly smell of an old paperback reached my nostrils. I've always loved that smell, even though the book collector side of me knew that it was a sign of a book that had been improperly maintained over the years, a book that had probably sat in a cardboard box on the floor of a damp cellar for too many seasons. But to me, the smell took me instantly back to the Annie's Book Swap, where I began to buy books when I was in the sixth grade. I grew up in Middle M, about 45 minutes west of Boston. The year that I turned 11 was also the year that I was allowed to ride my bike the mile and a half along Dartford Road into Middle M's town center. There were only three stores: a convenience store that called itself Middle M General, in an attempt to sound like something quainter than what it was, an antiques shop located in the old post office building, and an Annie's Book Swap, a franchised used bookstore run by an Englishman named Anthony Blake. It sold primarily mass markets, those paperbacks that could just about fit in a back pocket, and it was there that I bought the Ian Fleming novels and the Peter Benchleys and the Agatha Christies that got me through my younger years. It was there that I almost definitely bought The Drowner, having already purchased every available Travis McGee book, John D. McDonald's famous series. It was rare to find McDonald's standalones, but some devoted crime reader in my part of Massachusetts must have died around the time I started riding my bike to the town center, because Annie's was suddenly swamped with stacks of pulp novels, not just John D. McDonald, but Mickey Spillane books, and Alistair MacLean's and Ed McBain's 87th Precinct novels. I allowed myself three books per shopping expedition, which just about used up my allowance. In those days, it took me less than a week to read those three books. Sometimes it took me just 3 days, but I was always happy to reread books I already owned. I probably hadn't read The Drowner since then, since I was a preteen, but the basic plot had stuck with me. The villain, and she was a good one, was a highly religious secretary who sublimated all her repressed sexual energy into physical exercise. She murdered the sinful people around her, including a married woman having an affair with her boss. She drowned her by lurking in scuba gear at the bottom of the pond where this woman swam. Then she got hold of one of her legs and pulled her down under the water. That particular murder I never forgot. When I made up my perfect murders list, it had jumped into my mind. I didn't reread the book, but I familiarized myself with it. I brought The Drowner into bed with me. I read the first paragraph, its words hauntingly familiar. Books are time travel. True readers all know this. But books don't just take you back to the time in which they were written. They can take you back to different versions of yourself. The last time I'd cracked this particular paperback, I was probably 11 or 12. I like to think it was summertime, and I was up late in my cramped bedroom under a single sheet, a mosquito probably whining in one of the corners of the room. My father was playing his records in the living room, too loudly, depending on how drunk he was. Most nights ended the same, with my mother turning down his music, jazz usually, although sometimes he'd listen to fusion stuff like Frank Zappa or Weather Report, and my father berating her for not understanding him. But this was simply background noise, because I wasn't really there in that bedroom. I was actually in Florida in 1963, hanging out with shady real estate developers and sexy divorcees and drinking bourbon highballs. And now, here I was again, almost 40 years old, and my eyes were running over the same words, holding the same book I held 28 years ago, the same book some businessman or housewife held 50 years ago. Time travel. I finished the book at about 4 in the morning. I almost got out of bed to get another book from the list, but decided to try and sleep instead. I rolled onto my stomach, thinking about the book, about what it must feel like to be swimming along in a pond when something grabs you from below, pulls you down to your death. Then, because I was starting to get sleepy, my wife's face came into my mind, as it always did. But I didn't dream of her, and I didn't dream about the drowner. I dreamed about running, about people coming after me. The same dream I have every night of my life. It was still snowing when I left my apartment in the morning, but it was a light, drifting snow, half of it kicked up by a wind that was still gusting. There was about 2 feet already on the ground. The roads had been plowed, but no one had been out yet to shovel the sidewalks, so I walked in the middle of the street, careful going down the steep hill to Charles. Even though the skies were blanketed in clouds, the day was bright, maybe from all that pristine snow. I carried my old bike messenger bag, its strap over my shoulder. I got to the hotel early. The flat of the hill was a recent addition to my part of Boston, a boutique hotel inside a refurbished warehouse just off Charles. It had a high-end restaurant and a pretty bar that I occasionally went to on Monday nights when oysters were a dollar each. "I'm meeting someone for breakfast," I said to the lone employee, a sad-eyed woman behind the check-in desk, and she directed me past the bar into a small dining area with about 8 tables. There was no one there to seat me, so I sat myself at a corner table by a large window that looked out onto a wall of brick. I was the only one in the room, and I wondered if anyone was actually working there, or if all the staff were unable to make it to work because of the snowstorm. Then, simultaneously, a man in a crisp white shirt and black pants pushed through a pair of swinging doors while Agent Mulvey appeared at the entrance to the dining room. She spotted me and came over, just as the waiter was dropping off menus. We both ordered coffee and juice. "The FBI has a decent travel budget," I said. She looked confused for a moment, then said, I booked this place myself because it was close to your store. Who knows if they'll reimburse me?" "How'd you sleep?" I asked. She had dark purple shadows under her eyes. "Very little. I was reading."
"Me too. What book did you read?"
"The Red House Mystery. I thought I'd start at the beginning."
"What did you think?" I said, and took a sip of my coffee, scalding the tip of my tongue.
"It was good. Clever, I guess, and I didn't guess the ending."
She touched the side of her porcelain coffee cup and leaned down, pursing her lips and sipped a little bit from the top. The maneuver made me think of a bird. "Honestly," I said, "I know I included it on my list, but I don't remember the exact details. I read it a long time ago."
"It's pretty much how you described it. It's a country house mystery that is kind of ludicrous. I kept thinking about Clue, the game.
Colonel Mustard in the library."
"Exactly. But it was better than that."
She described to me the basic plot, and it started to come back. There's a rich man named Mark Ablett who lives in a country house, the kind of English one that seems specifically designed to have a murder occur in it. He gets a letter from his estranged, no-good brother saying he's coming to visit from Australia. When the brother arrives, he's told to wait in the study for Mark Ablett. Then a shot is heard. The brother from Australia is dead, and Mark Ablett is missing. It seems clear that Mark has killed his own brother and fled. The detective in the story is actually just a passing acquaintance of one of the country estate's guests. His name is Tony Gillingham, and together with his friend Bill, they begin to investigate. It turns out that there is a secret tunnel that runs from the study underneath the house and all the way out to a golf course, and there are, of course, multiple suspects. "There's no brother, right?" I said, interrupting her.
"Right, exactly. The real brother died years ago and isn't part of the present action. Mark Ablett had been talked into impersonating him, and then he's killed. But that wasn't the part of the murder that I found clever.
Did you?
She was talking fast, and only after she paused did I realize that she was expecting an answer. I think I put it on the list because the murderer had basically provided a corpse and a killer at the same time. They were the same person, but only the killer knew that.
Can I read a section I underlined last night?
Sure, I said, and she pulled the paperback from her bag and began flipping through pages. I could see from where I was seated that she'd underlined several passages. I thought of my wife, the way she would always read with a pen in her hand, ready to write in whatever book she was reading. I was suddenly glad I hadn't given Agent Mulvey the expensive first edition of Strangers on a Train.
Okay, got it,
she said, flattening the book on the table and leaning forward to read.
The inspector had arrived in it, the house I think he's talking about, to find a man dead and a man missing, she began. It was extremely probable, no doubt, that the missing man had shot the dead man. But it was more than extremely probable. It was almost certain that the inspector would start with the idea that this extremely probable solution was the one true solution, and that, in consequence, he would be less disposed to consider without prejudice any other solution.
She finished reading and closed the book.
It's got me thinking, she continued. If you were going to commit a murder based on this book, how would you do it?
I must have looked confused because she added,
Would you shoot someone in the study of a country house?
No, I said. I guess I would kill two people, then hide one of the bodies, and make it look as though the killer has gone on the run.
Exactly, she said.
The waiter was hovering, so we both ordered. Agent Mulvey got the eggs Florentine. I wasn't hungry, but ordered two poached eggs on toast with fresh fruit on the side. After we ordered, she said,
This has me thinking about rules.
What do you mean, rules?
Okay, she said and thought for a moment. If I was the one who had set myself this task, this goal of committing the 8 murders that you described in your list, then it would be helpful to set some guidelines, some rules. Do you copy the murders exactly, or the idea behind the murders? How similar do they have to be?
So you think the rules dictate that the murderer adheres as closely as possible to the actual murders in the book?
No, not the details of the murders, but the philosophies behind them. It's almost as though the murderer is testing these books in real life. If the idea was simply to mimic the books, then you could just shoot someone in a country house library and call it a day. Or for the ABC murders, you'd actually copy them exactly. You know, find someone named Abby Adams who lived in Acton and kill her first, etc. But it's not just about that. It's about doing them right. There are rules.
So for the Red House mystery, it's all about pointing the police toward a suspect that they will never find and never get to question.
Yes, exactly, Agent Mulvey said. It actually is clever. I was thinking about it all last night. Let's say I wanted to kill someone. My ex-boyfriend, for example.
Okay, I said.
If I just killed him, then I would be a suspect. But let's say I killed two people, like my ex-boyfriend and my ex-boyfriend's new girlfriend, say, and made sure that the body of the new girlfriend wasn't found. That way, I could make it look like the killer had run away. The police wouldn't be looking for the identity of the killer. They'd think they already knew it.
It wouldn't be easy, you know, I said.
Huh, she said. I wasn't really considering it.
Because the killer would have to be willing to kill two people.
Right.
And hiding a body is not easy.
You're not speaking from experience, are you?
She said. I've read a lot of mystery novels.
I think I need to look for a crime in which the prime suspect has disappeared.
Is that common? I asked.
It isn't, really. It's not so easy to disappear these days. Most people leave pretty obvious trails. But it happens.
I think you're on to something, I said.
It might be a matter of looking for two deserving victims, criminals, maybe, one of whom died and one who disappeared. That is, if your theory is correct, that... what should we call our suspect? We should have a name. Why don't we call him... she paused. Something with a bird. No, that's confusing. Let's call him Charlie, she said. Why Charlie? It just popped into my head. No, that's not true. I was trying to think of a name, and I thought of Copycat, which made me think of a cat, which made me think of my first cat when I was young, and his name was Charlie. Poor Charlie. Does he deserve to have his name used this way? He does, actually. He was a total killer. Brought us a mouse or a bird every day. Perfect, I said. Charlie it is. So, what was I saying? Right, look for deserving pairs of victims. Charlie doesn't like to kill innocent people. We don't know that for a fact, but it's a possibility, she said, pushing herself a little back from the table to allow her food to be put in front of her. Thank you, she said to the waiter, then picked up a fork. Mind if I eat and talk? I skipped dinner last night and I'm starving. No, that's fine, I said. My poached eggs had arrived, and the sight of them, the edges of the whites slightly translucent, made my stomach flip. I speared a cube of cantaloupe on the end of my fork. And maybe I'm wrong, Agent Mulvey said, when she was done chewing her first bite of breakfast. This could have something to do with you, of course. Someone trying to get your attention. Maybe someone trying to frame you? She opened her eyes a little wider as she said this. I jutted out my lower lip as though thinking about the possibility. And if that's the case, I finally said, then it makes sense to ensure that the murders have obviously been based on the books on the list. Right, she said. That's why I want to look more closely at what happened to Elaine Johnson, the heart attack victim. Who might or might not have been killed by Charlie, I said. But if she was, then I need to go to the crime scene. There might be something that connects it to Death Trap. I have a confession to make, I said, and watched as Agent Mulvey's cheeks reddened in anticipation. I haven't actually ever seen the play or even read it, but I have seen the movie and I'm pretty sure that it's very faithful. Anyway, I'm embarrassed. You should be, she said, but laughed. Her face was no longer red. So, in the movie, All I Can Actually Talk About, I said, the victim dies of a heart attack when she sees a man she thinks is dead loom up in her bedroom and murder her husband. Was Elaine Johnson found dead in her bedroom? I'll have to check, she said. I can't remember offhand. You know, when you said you had a confession, I thought you were going to say something else. You thought I was going to confess to being Charlie? I said, in what I hoped was a flippant way. No, she said. I thought you were going to confess to me that you knew Elaine Johnson. Chapter 6. I hesitated, then said, is she the same Elaine Johnson who used to live in Boston? Uh-huh. Then I did know her. Not well, but she used to come into the bookstore all the time, and she used to come to author readings. You didn't want to tell me this yesterday afternoon? Honestly, it didn't occur to me that it was the same person. The name rang a bell, but it's a common name. Okay, she said, but her eyes didn't quite meet mine. What was she like, Elaine Johnson? I pretended to think, just to buy a little time, but the truth was, Elaine was memorable. She had seriously thick glasses, I think you'd call them Coke bottles, and thinning hair, and she always wore what appeared to be handmade sweaters, even in summertime. But none of that was what had made her memorable. She was memorable because she was one of those people who take advantage of the vulnerable nature of retail employees by cornering them and subjecting them to endless monologues, more like diatribes, on her favorite subjects. Elaine's favorite subject was crime writers. Who was a genius, who was merely good, and who was bad. Fucking atrocious was the phrase she generally used. And she used to come into the store every day and corner whatever employee she encountered first. It was exhausting and annoying, but we all figured out the best way to deal with her, which was to continue working while she talked, give her about 10 minutes, then tell her in no uncertain terms that her time was up. It sounds rude, but the thing is, Elaine Johnson was rude herself. She said outrageous things about the authors she didn't like. She was casually racist, openly homophobic, and surprisingly loved to comment on other people's appearances, despite her own. I think anyone who works in a bookstore, or any store, probably is used to dealing with difficult customers, including difficult customers who come in every day. The thing about Elaine Johnson was that she also showed up at all our author readings, and she was always the first to raise her hand, asking a question that subtly or not so subtly insulted the poor author on stage. We would always warn the authors in advance, but we'd also mention that she always bought a copy of the book to get it autographed, even when they were, according to her, a no-talent fraud. Most authors, I find, are willing to put up with an asshole if it means a book sale, especially a hardcover book sale. I knew that Elaine Johnson had moved to Rockland, Maine, because she told us about the move on a daily basis for about a year before it happened. Her sister had died and left her a house. On the day she finally left, my employees and I went out for a celebratory drink. "She was pretty abrasive," I said to Agent Mulvey. She came to the store every day and cornered one of us to talk about the book she was reading. I remember now that she did move to Maine, but I didn't connect the name when you said it. I just knew her as Elaine, not Elaine Johnson. "Did she deserve to die?" she asked. I raised my eyebrows. "Did she deserve to die? Are you asking me personally? No, of course not." "No, sorry. I mean, you said she was an abrasive personality. It's clear, at least to me, that all the victims so far have been less than likable people. Did she fall into the category?"
"She was definitely not likable. She told me once that lesbians made terrible writers because they didn't spend enough time with men who had superior intellects."
"Oh." "She used to say stuff just to get a rise, I think. Ultimately, she was sad and lonely, more so than a terrible person."
"Did you know she had a weak heart?"
After her surgery, I remember her pulling down the neck of her pilly sweater to show me the puckered scar on her wrinkled chest. I remember saying, "Please don't ever show that to me again," which got a laugh. Sometimes I thought that Elaine Johnson's act was just that, an act, and what she really craved was people being rude to her back. "It rings a bell," I said to Agent Mulvey. I remember there was a time when she didn't come into the store. We were all thrilled. But then she started to come back. I remember it was medical. The waiter had sidled over. Agent Mulvey's plate was spotless, and my eggs were untouched. He asked if everything was okay.
"Sorry," I said. "It's fine. I'm still working on these."
He cleared the agent's plate, and she ordered more coffee. I decided to make an attempt on my eggs, thinking it would look strange if I didn't. Agent Mulvey looked at her watch and asked me if I was going in to work. "I'll go in," I said. "I doubt I'll have any customers, but I'll check on Nero."
"Oh, Nero,"
she said, with affection in her voice. I remembered that she had cats of her own and asked her, "Who's looking after your cats?" As soon as I said it, I realized that it was a very personal question. It also sounded as though I was trying to figure out if she was single. I wondered if she thought I was hitting on her. I wasn't a whole lot older than she was, 10 years, maybe, although I did know that my hair, prematurely white, made me look a little older.
"They're fine,"
she said, avoiding the question.
They have each other.
I continued to eat, and she glanced at her phone, then put it face down back on the table.
I do have to ask you where you were the night of September 13th, the night that Elaine Johnson died?
Of course, I said. What night was it?
It was the 13th.
No, the day of the week.
Let me check.
She picked her phone back up, scrolled for 10 seconds, then said,
It was a Saturday night.
I was away, I said. In London.
I take the same vacation every year, 2 weeks in London, usually at the beginning of September. It's low tourist season because the kids are back in school, but the weather is usually still good. Plus, it's an okay time to be away from the store.
Do you know the exact dates you were away? She asked.
If the 13th was Saturday, then I flew back the next day on Sunday, the 14th. I can send you the flights I was on, if you'd like. I know it was basically the first 2 weeks in September.
Okay, thanks, she said,
which I took to mean that she wanted me to send her my exact flights. If Elaine Johnson was killed by Charlie, I said.
Yes?
Then it makes it much more likely that Charlie is definitely using my list.
Yes, it does. And it means that he not only knows who you are, but that he knows people around you.
I'm assuming it can't be a coincidence that one of the victims is someone you knew personally. I don't think so, I said.
Is there anyone who has a grudge against you? Maybe an ex-employee? Someone who might have known that Elaine Johnson was a regular at Old Devil's?
Not that I know of, I said. There aren't that many ex-employees from the store, actually. I only need 2 extra people, and the 2 I have now have both been with me for over 2 years.
Can you tell me their names? She said,
pulling a notebook out from her bag. I gave her Emily's and Brandon's full names, and she wrote them down.
What can you tell me about them? She said.
I told her what I knew. It wasn't much. Emily Barsamian had graduated from Winslow College outside of Boston about 4 years ago and gotten an internship at the Boston Athenaeum, a prestigious and historic independent library. She'd supplemented her income by coming to work at Old Devil's for 20 hours a week. When the internship was finished, she upped her hours and had been with me ever since. I knew hardly anything about her personal life because she rarely talked, and when she did, it was only about books or sometimes movies. I suspected that she was a secret writer, but hadn't confirmed it. Brandon Weeks was my gregarious employee. He still lived with his mom and his sisters in Roxbury, and both Emily and I probably knew everything about him, certainly everything about his family and about his current girlfriend. When I'd hired him as extra help during the holiday season 2 years ago, I admit that I had doubts about whether he'd show up with any kind of regularity. But he stayed on, and as far as I remembered, had never missed a single day or even been late.
And that's it? Agent Mulvey asked.
For current employees? Yes. I go in every day myself. And when I go on vacation, either we hire a temp, or Brian, my co-owner, comes in and does a few shifts. If you want, I'll put together a list of past employees and send it to you.
Brian is Brian Murray, she said.
Yes, you know him?
I saw his name on your website. I've heard of him, yes.
Brian is a semi-famous writer who lives in the South End and who writes the Ellis Fitzgerald series. He's easily up to about 25 books by now. They don't sell as well as they used to, but Brian writes them anyway, keeping his female detective Ellis at a perpetual 35 years old and keeping both fashion and technology advancements out of his narratives. The books are set sometime in late 80s Boston, as was the TV series called Ellis that ran for 2 years and provided Brian with the townhouse he bought in the South End, his lake house in the far north of Maine, and enough extra money to invest in Old Devil's.
Include other people on your list if you think of them. Pissed off customers? Any exes of yours we should know about?
It's going to be a short list, I said. My only ex is my wife, and she's dead.
Oh, I'm sorry, she said, but it was clear from her expression she already had that information.
And I'll keep thinking about the books on the list.
Thank you, she said. Don't hold back. Let me know any thoughts you have, even if they seem insignificant or unlikely. It can't hurt.
Okay, I said, folding my napkin and putting it over the uneaten portion of my breakfast. Are you checking out or are you staying here?
Checking out, she said. Unless for some reason the train is canceled, then I guess I'll spend one more night here. But I'm not leaving right now. You haven't told me if you looked at the unsolved crimes I gave you last night.
I told her that none of them had jumped out at me, except for possibly Daniel Gonzalez, the man who'd been shot while jogging.
How does it relate to your list? She asked.
It probably doesn't, but it made me think of the Donna Tartt book, The Secret History. In that book, the killers wait for their victim at a place they think he might be hiking.
I read that book in college, she said.
So you remember?
Sort of. I thought they killed someone doing a sex ritual in the woods.
That's the first murder. They kill a farmer. The second murder is the one I reference in the list. They push their friend off a cliff.
Daniel Gonzalez was shot.
I know, it's a long shot. It has more to do with the fact that he was out walking his dog. Maybe it's a walk he does every day or once a week. It probably has nothing to do.
No, it's helpful. I'll look into it further. There were several persons of interest in the Daniel Gonzalez case, including a former student who is still under investigation. But it does seem like a possibility.
Was Daniel Gonzalez an asshole? I said, for lack of a better word.
That I don't know, but I'll check it out. It seems likely, though, if there were several persons of interest in his killing.
So that was the only case, the Gonzalez one? Yes, I said. I did think that you should look outside of unsolved homicides, though. Look at accidental drownings and also accidental overdoses. Oh, that reminds me. I opened my bike messenger bag and pulled out the two books I'd brought with me, the paperback copy of The Drowner that I'd reread the night before, plus a paperback copy of Malice Aforethought that I'd found in my personal collection that morning. It was a Pan Books paperback in very poor condition, the cover almost falling off. I slid both across to Agent Mulvey.
Thanks, she said. I'll make sure they get returned to you.
Don't worry too much about it, I said. Neither is irreplaceable. And I read The Drowner last night. Read it again, I mean, because it had been a while since I last read it.
Oh yeah? She said. Any insights?
There are two murders in it. There's the woman who gets killed while swimming. She's pulled down from below, basically what the cover is showing you. But there's a second murder, a really disturbing one. The killer, who's this very physically strong woman, almost supernaturally strong, kills a man by giving him a heart attack with her hand. She holds it rigid, like this, I demonstrated by holding up my hand, fingers extended, and pushes it slowly up under his rib cage until she can feel his heart, and then she wrenches it. Ugh, the agent said and made a face. I don't know if it's even possible, I said. And even if it was, I'm pretty sure an autopsy would show what happened.
I think so too, she said.
I still think we should look for drownings. I think our Charlie would want to copy the drowning killing, especially since it's the title of the book. Right, I said.
Did you get anything else from the book?
I didn't tell her how I hadn't remembered just how sexualized the killings were. That Angie, the insane murderer, imagined two personalities for herself, a Joan of Arc side in which her purity made her impervious to pain. But then there was a side to her that she called her red mare feeling, her back arched, her nipples erect, and how she experienced both of these personalities when she committed a murder. It made me wonder if all murderers needed to do this, needed to disassociate during the act, become someone else. Was Charlie like this? But what I said to Agent Mulvey was, it's actually not a great book. I love John D. MacDonald, but except for the Angie character, this wasn't one of his best. She shrugged and put both the books in her own bag. I realized that my critical assessment of the book was not exactly relevant. Still, she looked up and said, "You've been incredibly helpful. Do you mind if I send you anything I might have for your opinion? And if you'd keep rereading the books..." "Of course," I said. We exchanged emails, then stood, and she walked me to the entrance of the hotel. "I want to look at the weather," she said, stepping outside with me. The snow was barely falling now, but the city was transformed. Drifts of snow gathered in corners, the trees bent over, even the brick walls of nearby buildings coated with a scrim of white. "Good luck getting home," I said. We shook hands. I called her Agent Mulvey, and she asked me to call her Gwen. As I walked slowly away through the shin-high snow, I decided it was a good sign, her asking me to call her by her first name. Chapter 7. When I got to the store 20 minutes later, Emily Barsamian was under the awning looking at her phone. "How long have you been here?" I asked. 20 minutes. When I didn't hear from you, I just figured we'd be open for regular hours. "Sorry, you should have sent me a text message." I said this, knowing that in 4 years she had never sent me a text message, and that she probably never would. "I didn't mind waiting," she said, as I opened the door, then followed her in. "It was my fault for forgetting my keys." Nero came over to greet us, meowing, and Emily crouched down to scratch his chin. I went behind the checkout desk and turned on the lights. Emily stood and removed her long green coat. Underneath, she wore what I had come to think of as her work uniform, a mid-length dark skirt, chunky boots, a vintage sweater over a button-up shirt, or occasionally a t-shirt. The t-shirts she wore provided rare clues as to Emily's likes and dislikes. Some of the shirts were book-related. She had one with a vintage cover of Shirley Jackson's We Have Always Lived in the Castle, with an illustration of a black cat in tall green grass, and several were t-shirts for a band called the Decemberists. The previous summer, she wore a t-shirt that advertised Summer Isle, May Day, 1973, and I spent all day with a nagging feeling that it sounded familiar. I finally asked her, and she told me it was referencing The Wicker Man, a horror film from the 1970s I hadn't seen in many years. "You're a horror fan?" I asked. As usual, when we spoke, she was looking at either my forehead or my chin. "I guess," she said. "What are your top five?" I said, hoping to continue the conversation. She frowned briefly, thinking, then said, "Rosemary's Baby, The Exorcist, Black Christmas, the original one, Heavenly Creatures, and, The Cabin in the Woods, I guess." "I've seen 2 out of 5. What about The Shining?" "Uh-uh." She shook her head rapidly, and I thought she might elaborate, but that was the end of the conversation. I didn't mind that she was a private person. I was as well. And being a private person is a rare trait these days. Still, I did wonder about her interior life, and I wondered if she had ambitions besides being a bookseller. As she hung up her damp coat, I asked her if it had been hard getting to the store. "I took the bus. It was fine," she said. She lived on the other side of the river, near Inman Square in Cambridge. All I knew about her living situation was that she shared a 3-bedroom apartment with 2 other Winslow College graduates. Emily went to the back, to the table where I stacked the new arrivals. Her primary job was updating and monitoring our online stores. We sold used books through eBay and Amazon and a site called Alibris and a few more that I didn't even know about. I used to do some of it myself, filling orders, but Emily had taken over completely. That was one of the reasons I was anxious about her future plans. If she ever left here, I'd be in big trouble. I stayed behind the counter and checked the phone for messages. There were none. Then logged on to the Old Devil's blog, something I rarely did these days. But the visit from Gwen Mulvey made me interested in taking a look. There were 211 total blog entries, the last one entered 2 months ago. It was called Staff Picks, and it was something I periodically forced Emily and Brandon to do. Write 2 sentences on the last book they'd read and loved. Brandon had picked Lee Child's last Jack Reacher novel, and Emily had written a quick blurb on Dorothy B. Hughes's In a Lonely Place. My pick had been Started Early, Took My Dog by Kate Atkinson. I hadn't read it, of course, but I'd read enough reviews and summaries to feel as though I had. Also, I was fond of the title. I spent the next hour or so scrolling backward through blog entries, and it was like living the past 10 years of my life in reverse. There was John Haley's first and last entry, posted on the week he left the store, leaving me in charge. He'd sold Old Devils and all its stock to Brian Murray and me in 2012. Brian had put up most of the capital, but given me 50% ownership share since I'd be the one running it. So far, it had worked out. I thought at first that Brian would want to be more involved than he was, but that hadn't been the case. He came to the store for our annual holiday party, along with attending almost all our readings, but other than that, he has left me in charge, except for those 2 weeks a year when I take my annual trip to London. I did see Brian frequently, though. It took him about 2 months to write an entry in his Ellis Fitzgerald series. The rest of the year he called his drinking vacation, most of which he spent on a leather-padded stool at the small bar of the Beacon Hill Hotel. I stopped in often to have a drink with him, although I tried to do it early in the evening. If I arrived too late, Brian, a habitual storyteller, would play his greatest hits for me, stories I'd heard 100 times already. I scrolled farther back through the posts, noting the absence of any from 5 years ago, the year my wife died. The last entry before that event had been a list I'd written called Mysteries for a Cold Winter Night, posted on December 22, 2009. My wife died in the early morning hours of January 1, 2010. She'd been in a car accident, sliding off an overpass on Route 2 while inebriated. They'd shown me pictures for identification purposes, a white sheet covering her head from the eyebrows up. Her face looked unmarked, even though I imagined her skull had completely collapsed from the impact. I read the list of mysteries I'd selected, all ones that took place in wintertime or during a storm. At this point in my blog writing career, I was happy to just list books and not describe them. This was my post. The Sittaford Mystery, 1931 by Agatha Christie. The Nine Tailors, 1934 by Dorothy L. Sayers. The Corpse in the Snowman, 1941 by Nicholas Blake. Tied Up in Tinsel, 1972 by Nio Marsh. The Shining, 1977 by Stephen King. Gorky Park, 1981 by Martin Cruz Smith. Smilla's Sense of Snow, 1992 by Peter Hu. A Simple Plan, 1993 by Scott Smith. The Ice Harvest, 2000 by Scott Phillips. Raven Black, 2006 by Anne Cleves. I remembered putting it together, remembered worrying about including The Shining because it was a horror novel and not at all a mystery, but included it anyway because it was a book I loved. It was strange to remember such minutiae, these insignificant thoughts I'd had less than 2 weeks before my world would change forever. If I could go back to late December of that year, then I would never have written this list. I would have spent all my time fighting tooth and nail for my wife, telling her that I knew about her affair, that I knew she was doing drugs again, telling her I forgave her, and that she could come back to me. Who knows if any of it would have made a difference, but at least I would have tried. I scrolled back some more, found another list, crime novels about cheating, and quickly checked the date. I didn't officially know about my wife at that point, but I must have guessed, must have known something was going on at a gut level. I kept scrolling backward, the blog posts coming more and more frequently as I reached the years when I'd been better at keeping the blog updated. I thought, not for the first time, Why does everything need to be a list? What compels us to do that? It was something I'd been doing ever since I became an obsessed reader, ever since I started spending all my money at Annie's Book Swap. 10 favorite books, 10 scariest books, best James Bond novels, best Roald Dahl. I suppose I know why I did it back then. It doesn't take a psychology degree to understand that it was a way of giving myself an identity. Because if I wasn't a 12-year-old who'd already read every single Dick Francis novel and could name the 5 best, then I was just a lonely kid without friends, with a distant mother and a father who drank too much. That was my identity. And who wants that? So I guess the question is, why keep doing it, making lists, even after I was living in Boston, had a good job, was married and in love? Why wasn't all that enough? Eventually, I made it all the way back to the start of the blog, to 8 Perfect Murders. I'd read it so many times in the past 24 hours that I didn't need to read it again. The front door opened, and I lifted my head. It was a middle-aged couple, both encased in puffy winter coats with hoods. They were probably already large under their coats, but the added layers rendered them almost spherical. They had to walk single file through the door. When their hoods were down and their parkas unzipped, they approached me, smiling, introduced themselves as Mike and Becky Swenson from Minnesota. I recognized them immediately as a certain kind of customer we occasionally get, fanatical mystery readers who make a point to visit us during their trip to Boston. Old Devils is not a famous store, but we are famous to a certain kind of reader. "You brought your weather with you," I said, and they both laughed, told me how they'd been planning on coming to Boston for years. "Got to see Cheers, got to try some clam chowder, and definitely got to come to Old Devils," the man said. "Where's Nero?" his wife said, and as if on cue, Nero rounded the new releases shelf and visited the pair. We all had to chip in, I guess. Mike and Becky left an hour and a half later. It was 90% talking and 10% shopping, although they did buy $100 worth of signed hardcovers, giving me their address in East Grand Forks so that we could mail the books to them. "We forgot to leave any room in our suitcases," Becky said. It had stopped snowing when they left. They had taken several of our bookmarks with them as souvenirs, plus I'd steered them to a few restaurants in the nearby area that were better than Cheers. As I held the door for them, Brandon arrived, dressed only in a hooded sweatshirt, although he was wearing gloves and a woolly hat under the hood. I'd forgotten he was scheduled to come in today.
"You look surprised," he said. "It's Friday."
"I know," I said.
"Thank God it's Friday," he added in his booming voice, stretching the vowel sound on the word God to an impressive length. "And thank God, I've got work to go to, so I don't have to be home all day."
"Your class was canceled," I asked.
"Oh, yeah," he said.
He was taking business classes, mostly in the mornings, and had been since he'd started working at the bookstore. Last I checked, he would graduate soon, and I knew I'd most likely lose him. It was going to be fine, but I was going to miss his nonstop chatter. It was a nice counterpoint to Emily's silence. My silence as well, I guess. He pulled a paperback, Richard Stark's The Hunter, from the pouch at the front of the hoodie, and handed it to me.
"Effing awesome," he said.
When he'd first started at the store, I had to keep reminding him not to swear because of the customers, so he'd amended his ways. He'd borrowed the book from the store at my suggestion just 2 days earlier. Between working full-time and going to school and maintaining, according to him, a pretty active social life, he also managed to read about 3 books a week. I looked at the paperback, one in which the name of the book had been changed to Point Blank in order to reflect the Lee Marvin movie that was made in 1967.
"That's the way I got it, Mal," he said, meaning the condition of the book.
The borrow policy for employees meant they could take any book home to read just so long as they didn't add any extra wear to it. "No, it looks fine," I said.
Yeah, it does, Brandon said, then shouted, Emily,
in three equally accented syllables. She came out from the back and Brandon hugged her, something he occasionally did if it had been more than a day since he'd last been in the store. He only hugged me at the holiday party, and at the few occasions when we'd close up the shop and grab a quick beer at the Sevens. I am not a natural hugger, even though it is now standard greeting protocol among men of my generation. I can't get the movements down, especially if the hug involves one of those manly back slaps. Claire, my wife, when I told her about this particular anxiety, started to practice with me. For a while there, we'd greet each other at home with a man hug. Brandon followed Emily into the back room where he took the mail order list and began to assemble piles of books for shipping. A huge advantage of having the same employees here for so long is that I hardly ever have to tell them what to do. Because of their loyalty, I pay them far more than I suspect other retail places offer. I don't need the store to make a big profit, and I don't think Brian Murray cares that much either. He's just happy to be able to call a mystery bookstore his own, or half his own. I listened to Brandon tell Emily the entire plot of The Hunter while I updated new releases. Four more customers came in, all alone. A Japanese tourist, a regular named Joe Staley, a 20-something guy I knew by sight who always browsed through the horror section and never bought anything, plus a woman who had clearly come in only to escape the cold outside. I checked my phone for the weather. The snow was done now, but temperatures were dropping over the next few days into the teens. All the snow that had fallen was going to harden into piles of ice, black with city grime. I went back to my computer to check on emails, then glanced again at the blog site, still on the 8 Perfect Murders list. A sort of byline at the bottom of the list said that it was posted by Malcolm Kershaw, then gave the date and time of the post, then indicated that there were 3 comments. I remembered there being only 2, so I clicked through to read them. The latest comment was posted less than 24 hours earlier at 3 a.m. from a user named Dr. Shepherd and read, I am halfway through your list. Strangers on a Train, done. The ABC Murders, finally finished. Double Indemnity, kaput. Death Trap, saw the film. When I'm finished with the list, it won't be long now. I'll get in touch. Or do you already know who I am? Chapter 8. That night I cooked myself the pork chop that was in the refrigerator, although I was still shaken and I overcooked it. Its sides curled up and it was as tough as jerky. Since late afternoon and through until our closing time of 7, I hadn't been able to stop thinking about that 3rd comment on the Perfect Murders blog post. I must have read it 30 times now, parsing every word. The name used by whoever had written the post, Dr. Shepherd, nagged at me until I finally Googled it. It was the name of the narrator in Agatha Christie's famous novel, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. That was the book that put Christie on the map, so to speak. Written in 1926, it is most famous for a very clever plot twist. The book is told in first person from the point of view of Shepherd, a country village doctor and a neighbor of Hercule Poirot's. Honestly, I don't remember anything about the crime itself, except for the name of the victim, obviously. What I do remember is that at the end of the novel, it is revealed the narrator is the actual murderer. When I got home, I went immediately to my bookshelf and found my copy of Christie's book. I owned the Penguin paperback edition, one from the 1950s with the simple green cover and no artwork. I flipped through to see if it would somehow jog my memory as to the actual plot, but it didn't, and I decided I'd read it that night. Was it possible that whoever posted the comment was really only a reader, working his or her way through my list? I think it was a possibility, a very slim one, except for the fact of the books mentioned as having been read. They were the books for which there had already been a crime.
the ABC murders, Double Indemnity, and Death Trap. Strangers on a Train as well, although Gwen Mulvey doesn't know all about that one yet. I do, and someone else does as well. If these words are ever read, then I am sure that the reader might have already guessed that I have more to do with these crimes than I've been letting on. It's not as though there haven't been clues. For instance, why did my heart beat faster when Gwen Mulvey first began interviewing me? Why didn't I immediately tell her that I knew who Elaine Johnson was? Why did I only eat two bites of my sandwich the night after I was visited by the FBI agent? Why do I dream of being chased? Why did I not immediately tell Gwen about the comment from Dr. Shepherd? And a really astute reader might even have noticed that my name, shortened, is Mal. French, of course, for bad. That's taking it too far, though, because that really is my name. I've changed some names for the purposes of this narrative, but not my own. It is time to tell the truth. It is time to speak of Claire. That was her real name as well. Claire Mallory, who grew up in a wealthy town in Fairfield County, Connecticut, one of three sisters. Her parents were not particularly good people, but they weren't bad enough to really figure into this story. They were well off and shallow. Her mother, in particular, was obsessed with all three of her daughters' attractiveness and weight, and because she obsessed about it, that meant their father, devoid of any independent thoughts himself, agreed with her. They sent their children to summer camps in Maine and to fancy private schools, and Claire, who was the oldest, chose to go to Boston University because she wanted to be in a city, and both New York City and Hartford felt too close to where she'd grown up. At BU, she majored in film and television, wanting to be a documentary filmmaker. Her first year was okay, but in her second year, prompted by a boyfriend majoring in theater arts, she got heavily into drugs, particularly cocaine. As her habit grew, she began to have panic attacks, and that caused her to drink excessively. She stopped going to classes, was put on academic probation, briefly rebounded, then failed out her junior year. Her parents tried hard to get her to come home, but she stayed in Boston instead, renting an apartment in Alston and getting a job at the Red Line bookstore, where I'd just been promoted to manager. It was love at first sight, really. At least for me. When she came in to interview, it was clear that she was nervous, her hands trembling slightly, and she kept yawning, which seemed weird, but I was able to recognize it as a sign of extreme anxiety. She sat on a swivel chair in Mort's office, her hands resting on her thighs. She wore a corduroy skirt and dark leggings, plus a turtleneck. She was thin, noticeably so, and with a long neck. Her head seemed too big for her body, her face almost perfectly round. She had dark brown eyes, a thin nose, and lips that looked puffy and bitten. Her hair was very dark, cut in what I thought of as a bob. It looked like a dated style to me, something an intrepid amateur detective might wear in a 1930s film. She was so pretty that a dull throb had taken up residence in my solar plexus. I asked her about work experience. She had very little, but during the past few summers she'd worked at a Walden Books at her local mall down in Connecticut. "Who are your favorite writers?" I'd asked, and she looked surprised at the question. "Janet Frame," she said. "Virginia Woolf? Jeanette Winterson?" She thought for a while. "I read poetry as well. Adrienne Rich, Robert Lowell, Anne Sexton." "Sylvia Plath?" I'd asked, and inwardly cringed. It sounded stupid, mentioning the most famous confessional female poet, as though I were somehow reminding her of the name. "Sure," she said, then asked me who my favorite writers were. I told her. We kept talking this way, about writers, for the next hour, and I realized I'd only asked her one question about the actual job. "What hours will you be available?" I said. "Oh," she touched her cheek when she thought.
I noticed it right away, not aware in that moment of how many times I'd see her make that gesture, and how eventually I would see it not just as something endearing and individual, but as something worrying.
I don't know why I'm thinking about it, she said, laughing. Any hours?
It was 6 weeks before I got up the nerve to actually ask her out. Even then, I'd framed it as a work outing. Ruth Rendell was doing an event at the Boston Public Library, and I asked Claire if she wanted to join me. She'd said yes, then added, I haven't read her books, but if you like them, I should. A sentence that I analyzed in the following.